Welcome to the second episode of Culture Wars, Spheres of Influence in International Relations. On this show, we talk about how a country's cultural activities through sports, entertainment, and other avenues are used to spread cultural influence across borders that ultimately affect the power balance between countries and international relations. I am Jorlin Garcia.
And I'm Zoya Nawaz, and we're hosting this podcast sponsored by the Keck Center for International and Strategic Studies at Claremont McKenna College.
Today's episode will focus on how China has used soft power to rise on the world stage and its consequences for the future.
Our discussion today will be about the educational exports like Confucius Institutes, projects like the Shanghai World Expo in 2010, the Summer Olympics of 2008, and the growing influence of Chinese cinema as a competitor to Hollywood. We will discuss how China is using these mediums to gather cultural influence.
Our guest for today is Minxin Pei, a renowned expert on Chinese politics, U.S.-China relations, economic reform, and democratization. He has written a number of books on China, including his most recent, China's Crony Capitalism, The Dynamics of Regime Decay, and he regularly contributes articles and interviews to publications like NPR, Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy, and the South China Morning Post.
He is currently a professor of government at Claremont McKenna College and a non-resident senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. We're so happy to have him here today to talk to us about Chinese spheres of influence and soft power. Professor Pei, welcome.
Thank you. I'm very happy to talk with you.
So, Professor Pei, we know China has mostly been known for economic power as one of the world's largest exporting countries and economies, but over the decades, the country has expanded to include cultural spheres of influence in a variety of mediums. What do you think spurred China's quest to expand from hard power like military strength to also focus on soft power with cultural exports?
Yeah, there were many factors behind Chinese expansion of its cultural power or soft power abroad. Historically, when you look at countries that have become economically successful, they all tend to promote their cultural values or cultural products. Take the example of Japan. In the 1980s, after Japan became this miracle economy, Japan did precisely the same thing. Financing or supporting academic research on Japan, promoting Japanese studies abroad. So China, in this regard, is not an exception. It is actually rather the rule. I think what is problematic about China is its the ideological aspect. That is, unlike other countries that tend to focus purely on culture, there is an ideological element in China's export of soft power. So what is that element? That is a glorification of one-party state. That is very problematic because China is governed by dictatorship rather by a democracy. So that the other aspects of Chinese cultural power are not that controversial because people do like Chinese food. It is a very ancient civilization. So there is a lot to it in terms of arts, literature. So there's but also there is a very pragmatic aspect to Chinese cultural influence. The Chinese language, if China, which is now the world's second largest economy, is so economically influential, then you have to do business with China. And the most important impediment to doing business with China is really the language barrier. So China takes advantage of this need and tries to promote sort of Confucius Institute, which is really a language education institute. So these are the reasons, factors behind China's the rise of Chinese cultural power.
Yeah, that actually sounds really interesting. So actually, one of the most prominent cultural showcases in the world was the Shanghai World Expo in 2010. It was one of the most largest, most expensive, and the most attended world fairs, and it garnered significant coverage from Chinese and Western media, both before and also after the event. It tried to showcase Shanghai as the next great world city with the motto, better city, better life. So what do you think China gained from having hosted this event? Can China point to anything tangible, or was it just a waste of money?
Yeah, it so happened I was in Shanghai in 2010. And for me, that was not a very pleasant experience because they imposed very strict security measures. So as a visitor, it was really very inconvenient. But I think the more The expo was 2010, but the event that really put China on the global stage in terms of soft power was the Olympics of 2008, because that was a much more watched event globally. And until I think the 2014 Sochi Olympics, China, the Beijing Olympics was the most extravagant, most expensive, huge amount of money in the venues, in staging it, and the opening ceremony was sort of, in a technical way, very well done. I think China got a lot from its Olympics because before 2008, the notion of China outside China was mainly a very backward country, but 2008 changed how people looked at China. And the timing was also quite appropriate because 2008 was the global financial crisis. The rest of the world, especially the capitalist democratic West, was not doing well. This authoritarian rising China was doing really well, putting on this show. And then incidentally, at Beijing Olympics, Chinese athletes won more gold medals than anybody, especially the US. So that was a much more, in terms of return on investments in cultural power, 2008 was a lot more profitable for China. 2010, the Shanghai Expo was much more controversial, largely because it was not really that well known outside China. I don't even know which country is hosting the next expo, right? But everybody knows which country is hosting the next Olympics. Pop quiz, 2024, it's Paris. 2028, it's Los Angeles. It's our hometown. By and large, I believe the Chinese government has wasted a lot of resources in trying to promote large projects, extravagant events, such as the Beijing Olympics and the Shanghai Expo. That is, the Chinese government has two things to say. One is its long civilizational history, Chinese culture. There's a lot to, because it's really the one of the longest lasting continuing civilizations. The other is its rapid economic development, the so-called competence that China can get things done. But unfortunately, the Chinese government wants to smuggle in a third theme, that is one party state works better than democracy, which is really controversial. And it's a message that does not sell well in the West. It may appeal to people in developing countries because people in developing countries face multiple challenges. And the most immediate basic challenge is survival. So if somebody can come along, can promise security, physical security above all, then they might find that model appealing. But the question is, can China do better with its resources? Because when you look at investments on the order of $30 billion, $40 billion, that's Beijing Olympics supposedly cost $35 billion. I don't know how much the Shanghai Expo cost, probably on the order of $10 billion. How can you justify that kind of investments if pupils or children in poor parts of China cannot get schooled? They still have to pay high school tuition. So that's why I would say that on balance, I think that's money poorly spent. But then you're talking to a one-party state. What can you do?
Yeah, now that you say that the money could have been used for better uses, do you think that even when it has spent so much money on extravagant events, have these events been successful in promoting their culture and their politics, even if the money could have been better spent elsewhere?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, but very difficult to make an assessment. That is, these events tend to have a very short-term impact. So Beijing Olympics, people talk about Beijing Olympics, say within a year, but then other things happen, so they forget about Beijing Olympics. Shanghai Expo, I think today, not many people actually talk about this, but at the same time, China keeps doing things that damages its brand, damages its image, right? So it's like somebody who sweeps his neighbor's say, sidewalk one day. And the next day, he tries to push his fence over the boundary. So his neighbor will actually get really upset. Or the next day, he beat up his children, beat up his wife. So you have to take that kind of image into consideration, this kind of analogy. Because while China is trying to project itself as a very successful one-party state, to some extent, that does have factual basis, right? The Chinese economy has really done quite well. But at the same time, the Chinese government is also doing horrible things, such as persecuting ethnic minorities, such as imposing tight restrictions of freedom of speech, and bullying its neighbors, claiming territories that it has no legal basis to claim. So how can this kind of government actually sort of be assured that it will have this very nice external image abroad?
Yeah, it's very much back and forth. Like you're saying, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. But now, like, we shift gears toward education, like what you mentioned before with the Confucius Institutes. We know they are known worldwide for partnering with universities for Chinese language programs. So, but they have been met with a lot of backlash of a lot of them closing down over the last couple of years, especially in the US. So what is China's goals for establishing these Confucius Institutes, and how is using the route of education different from other forms of soft power?
I think that there are two goals, two objectives. One is overt, the other is covert. The overt part is easy to understand because China wants to take advantage of this rising need for Chinese language education. Just let's be frank, it is an unmet need. The Chinese language is so difficult. There are not many qualified teachers abroad to teach it. But at the same time, there's a rising need for studying language. So China believes that this is a demand it can meet. So and in the process, it can show case, its responsibility, its friendliness, its cultural appeal. But there is, unfortunately, a covert need. That is, what about the materials they use? What about the control China wants to exercise over these institutions? How will the materials, the textbooks, the education, the administrative relationship surrounding these institutes work? So that's, I think the controversy is really about the latter. That is, some of the practices China adopts in promoting or establishing Confucius Institutes are seen as not transparent, as seeing potentially political. So that's why in countries that have tense geopolitical diplomatic relations with China, especially the US, there's more resistance to it. If you ask me for my personal view, whether there should be so between the spectrum of banning these institutes and leaving them alone completely, I think there is a middle ground. That is, we have to recognize that the demand for Chinese language is not something the Chinese government has created. It comes from foreign countries, foreign societies. So the demand has to be met. And second is that, can you put in safeguards to ensure academic freedom, transparency, and non-politicization? I think you can. But if you go from one extreme to another, what happens is that you really review your sense of insecurity. I don't think that the Chinese government can accomplish that much with Confucius Institutes. If China can accomplish that much with its Confucius Institutes, that does not mean China is powerful. That means our societies are in deep trouble, right? A few language teachers can subvert our society, then there has to be something fundamentally wrong with our society. So it's really a reflection of our own lack of confidence if you want to ban Confucius society, Confucius Institutes. Let me just add one final word. I think the Chinese government should not promote Confucius Institutes abroad because there are students in China that still don't have free education. It's unconscionable for the Chinese government to throw money outside China while its own people are neglected.
So like how these institutes have also been met with a lot of backlash for promoting controversial Chinese politics, like in general, what does the backlash reveal for China's attempt to promote their culture?
I think the backlash reveals is that China has to face the fact that having a dictatorship governing the world's largest country, potentially, of course, the largest economy, is going to arouse a lot of suspicion, fear, and anxiety and resistance in other countries. It really cannot look at itself as if that China cannot expect to be another America, because the US was welcomed around the world, at least in most parts of the world, until Trump came along, largely because the US was promoting the values that most people identify with. Of course, the US government has done awful things and made mistakes in the past. But by and large, people believe that the values the US tries to promote, human rights, democracy, justice, access to basic human needs, these are the values people would accept. I think it's much more controversial for a dictatorship trying to appear to be a nice guy abroad, because people know dictatorships are not nice guys, and people who run dictatorships are not nice guys. So you have this really deeply embedded suspicion about China. It really cannot expect to have wild and genuine cultural appeals around the world.
So let's now move towards film. So Chinese cinema is the second largest film industry in the world. And in recent years, Chinese films have increasingly made their way to the Western market. A Chinese company named Wanda has even bought majority shares in the US AMC movie theater chain, where they're distributing Chinese films to the American audiences. They've also been making Chinese movies with prominent American actors like Christian Bale and Matt Damon. What is China gaining through cultural exports of films? Are they trying to build their image?
Yeah, well, the movie industry is really interesting because there were several aspects. One is pure commercial. So the AMC purchase was a commercial deal. Of course, the guy who did the deal, who, by the way, has now gone very silent, in China, tried to be a movie mogul. And I think by and large, the commercial aspect has not been very successful. I mean, Chinese forays outside the borders of China, you just don't see blockbusters. And then Hollywood Chinese co-production within China are mostly flops. The Great Wall, I think I don't want to watch that kind of movie. And that's because I think nothing can be worse when you combine Hollywood commercialism with dictatorship. Because dictatorship tries to control everything, and commercialism tries to appeal to an imagined audience that simply does not exist in China. Recently, what's interesting about China is that its domestic movie industry is growing very fast. There were very complex reasons, because I think finally they are, Chinese movie makers are producing entertaining and intellectually very light stuff, and sometimes really jingoistic movies like Wolf Warrior series that Chinese moviegoers would like to watch. So Hollywood movies have lost its appeal. I think another thing could be that really you have not seen fantastic Hollywood movies. So what about successful Chinese movies? There are several things to Chinese movies, successful, that appeal abroad. First of all, these movies are not shown inside China. They are banned inside China because they are produced outside the official channel. They may use Chinese actors, actresses, Chinese background, or even be shot in China, like Crouching Tiger. Well, Crouching Tiger was shown, okay. A lot of the Chinese movies, like To Live, Raise the Red Light, Red Lantern, Farewell My Concubine, these are very powerful, fantastic movies. But they're all banned in China today. They're not shown in China because they're so real. They reflect China's very traumatic history, and they are done with really amazing artistry, which shows the promise of Chinese movies. The tragedy is that these very artistic Chinese movies cannot be shown in China. And that again illustrates the limits on Chinese cultural exports imposed by its dictatorial political system. Just imagine how successful China's cultural exports in the category of movies would be if China does not have a censorship system. What we need to know about China is that great movies tend to come out of trauma, historical trauma, tragedy, and China has plenty of those. And the story of Chinese trauma has not been well told. The sad thing is that the Communist Party believes that telling Chinese tragedy casts the party in a very bad light. So it does not want these stories to be told. And if you have a chance, just watch To Live. It's really a powerful movie. Watch sort of Farewell My Concubine. I really cannot imagine more powerful stories than those told in these two movies.
Yeah, you mentioned briefly Hollywood. So how do you think the Chinese industry compares to Hollywood? And is China trying to become a leading film industry even when they don't show their own films to their domestic audience?
Yeah, well, the government wants to make China a second Hollywood, but the government is not succeeding. I think what today is that what is emerging in China is a private-public partnership. That you have movie financing that uses the Hollywood model. Studios are still owned by the government, but studios are driven by for-profit motive. So that's the Chinese model. I think the US model obviously is very, we're very familiar with it. It's really private sector. Going forward, China's trouble is finding good stories that can be turned into good movies. It has done well in the last couple of years, but these are really light comedies, nationalistic, Rambo type movies. Can you actually go beyond? Can you actually replicate the success of the Chinese movie industry in the 1990s? The 1990s, China, the Chinese government put a very light touch on the movie industry. So it produced really fantastic movies, but now it's very, very different.
Yeah, so besides what we have talked about today, in your opinion, are there any other important cultural exports that China is producing or it's considering in the future? What other markets do you think it is planning on entering or just improving in future?
Yeah, I think these are the areas we should look at. The areas where the Chinese government puts the least restrictions on tend to be the areas where the Chinese cultural influence grows the fastest. One area is science fiction. The Chinese government doesn't care that much about science fiction. So China now has probably one of the best writers in science fiction. So check that out. The other area is classical music. That is, you look at pianists. China now has really great classical pianists, violinists. The third area is abstract art, because China has this very big, wealthy entrepreneurial class, and they want to invest in contemporary modern art. So there's a big market. And so China in the last 20 years has produced really very impressive contemporary or modern art. Like Ai Weiwei, of course, he's a dissident artist, but there were a lot of very successful, very innovative artists. So there's one scene, as I said, runs through these different areas. That is where China has genuine artistic freedom, Chinese culture tends to shine brilliantly.
Do you think there's any potential for China ever overtaking the US and becoming a leading cultural powerhouse? Or is that only in the case when China eases on its like restrictions and like dictatorship models?
Yeah, as long as China has a one-party system, I don't see that happening. Incidentally, I have to say that the US cultural appeal is declining because the US status as a successful country is declining as well. Because when you look at the US, its democracy is under siege. Its racial problem is really serious. Its inequality is off the chart. And it cannot deal successfully with pandemic. So successful cultural appeal is part of an entire package. Economic success, innate cultural appeal, entrepreneurship, freedom, and government competence, and justice. So that's so when you look at a country like Russia, Russia has just amazing talent. It's ballet, it's figure skating. You look at these are top of the world. Just the rest of the world cannot even compare. But Russia is not, on the whole, a very appealing country. That's because it's a country that jails dissidents, that assassinates political opponents abroad. It does a lot of awful things. So it's just, it's not that sort of appealing on the whole. That's why I think the race for cultural supremacy, I hate to use the word supremacy, because of the top spot in cultural power, is a very difficult one. It's very dynamic. And that's what it should be, because I think the world is a very pluralistic, diverse place. And countries really need to shine. I think in the future, what we might see is a mosaic. Certain countries will shine really brightly in certain areas, and other countries will shine in other areas. But overall, you won't see one country that shines so brilliantly that all other countries lose sort of luster in comparison.
Yeah, I was just about to ask about that, if we are entering into a more multipolar world in terms of culture, because if it's not the US or China.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. When you look at the US, just because I think I'm familiar with the US, is that the Hollywood industry is actually very global now. Look, it's very hard to say it's hard. Just it so happens that the studios that produce and distribute these movies are American. Well, look at Nomadland. Nomadland is produced by a Chinese, directed by a Chinese director. And look at this year's Oscar nominations. Just there's a Korean movie. So that's a lot of British actors, actors. So I think that's globalization. So in the future, we should not talk about cultural power connected with a particular country. It is really about humanity. It's really a human endeavor in trying to realize its own cultural ambitions.
I think this is a great note to end on. Thank you, Professor Pei, for offering your insight into Chinese spheres of influence across the world, like Expo, Confucius Institutes, cinema, and sports.
It will be very interesting to see if Chinese culture becomes more prevalent, or like you said, have this more mosaic. So thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Culture Wars podcast is sponsored by the Keck Center for International and Strategic Studies, and the music is brought to you by Kevin McLeod at The Incompetent Tech with the song titled Industrious Ferret. I'm Zoya Navaz.
And I am Jorlin Garcia. We hope you enjoyed today's episode and continue listening next time. Thank you.